Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you politics without the boring bits. You can listen live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on Times Radio. Just ask your smart speaker to play Times Radio. Listen on your DAB radio or download the Times Radio app. Coming up on today's episode, it's a Wednesday, so it must be a PMQ's Unpacked Day. It's the last one of the year. Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer get to bring in their toys, wear their own clothes, and just have a muck about, as it's the last one of the year. Aisha Hazarika helps Tim Shipman and I to wheel the big telly in so we can watch it together, pausing the action from the House of Commons to analyse the key exchanges in real time. And Lara Spirit rounds up the best of the rest. That's coming up in just a moment. But first, it's these two.
The Columnists with Ali Burt, Alice Thompson and Robert Crampton on Times Radio.
Are they both here? Alice making it in the nick of time.
I got stuck on the tube with Mariella.
Did you?
Yeah. But she didn't realise I was going to be on air first. I don't think she could quite believe it when I said I was actually about to get on air.
Does she get through? Does she just get let through the barriers as a celebrity?
I think so. She's so much more of a celebrity.
Special,
I think she
special
just,
lift.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything. Where I was having to queue.
Well, thank you for making it in. Robert Crampton's here.
Yeah, I'm always here.
Showing
off
his biceps. Well, we'll come to that.
No, they're all covered up.
But he's not wearing a vest.
No, I am wearing a vest. It's
are
just
you?
It's under
well,
my
can
shirt.
You strip for us now?
No. No, it wouldn't work on the radio.
Well, it would, because it would be good for the socials.
No, I'm not going to do it.
You could bang on the socials.
No.
Okay. It's the reason we all came in.
No, it's not.
That's why Mariella's coming early. Thing is, Robert, if we were talking about a woman, this wouldn't be allowed, would it?
No, just not in this day and age. Sure.
Well, if we started saying to Alice, come on, pop your top off, we'd be in all sorts of trouble.
Well, yeah, I think, yes. Kind of different, isn't it?
Well,
yeah, and I haven't got the biceps either.
No,
so
well, we'll come
work.
To well, but this is what we call trailing ahead. We'll come to Robert's biceps in a moment. First, has Rishi Sunak pulled off an incredible heist against his opponents? Is he a political genius, or is this just trouble delayed, Alice?
I think it's not even trouble delayed. I mean, if you look at his polling today, it is almost, well, it's worse than Boris Johnson and almost as bad as Liz Truss, so it hasn't worked at all. And I think just the word Rwanda now just it sounds terrible. It's like everything that's wrong with this government, it's trying to solve something with one word, and it's, you know, the legality is incredibly tenuous, and it's divided the Tory party again and showed us that they really can't do anything at all anymore without having an argument.
What do you think, Robert?
I think that reminded me of that great scene, one of the many great scenes in Yes, Prime Minister, where Sir Humphreys explained to Bernard the difference between diplomacy and politics. And he said, diplomacy is about surviving into the next century. Politics is about surviving until Friday afternoon. And, or you could say till Christmas, which is, he's limping. Yeah, I mean, he's got it over the line. He hasn't got it over the line. He's got it, he's probably got it through, he's got through till Christmas. And then it all starts again in January. Only the first reading.
Just keep pushing it off. Push it off. Yeah. Put it off.
Until you get to the election.
And also you worry what he's promised those guys in order for them to abstain.
Yeah, and then
they
complained
against.
About the bacon and the sandwiches. I thought that was a bit low, actually.
Did they?
Yeah, they said it was flaccid and it was undercooked.
Flaccid and undercooked?
Yeah, I thought
said
that
Mark
was bad.
Francois.
Exactly.
Yeah. Takes on to no one.
Can I say, though, the ones I feel really, really sorry for are the ones on the fact-finding mission to Caribbean.
I know.
Who are they? What are they finding out?
International Development Committee, I think?
They were getting onto a plane on a fact-finding mission to the Caribbean, and they got yanked off to vote.
Oh, no, that's harsh.
Yeah.
What were they finding out? That it's warm and sunny in the Caribbean in
December. Just before
December.
Christmas.
Yeah.
Just before Christmas. Lovely time of the year. Lovely time of the year to go.
I'm sure they'll get on the next flight.
And poor,
I hope they did anyway.
Poor Graham Stewart sat through 10 days of COP.
And just as it got to the good bit, he had to come home. Yeah. The climate change minister.
Yeah.
To show how green he is. Really.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all very tragic. But no, I don't think he's shown political genius. I think he's probably made some promises that he didn't ought to have made and probably shouldn't keep. But anyway, he's got through to Christmas, and that's kind of what we're all doing at the moment, isn't it? Slog through to Christmas, see what happens in January.
I do sort of wonder, like, if these people, the rebels, they're not, you know, if they put down their amendments are not going to pass because there's no majority for them. Mm. So then what are they going to do? Vote down the bill so that there's no chance of the 90... You know, the government's calculation that 99.5% of legal challenges will fail or something.
Mm-hmm.
So are they going to vote it down so that there's no toughening? Because if there's no Rwanda bill, there's even less chance of a plane taking off. I don't know what the Trump card is that these rebels
have
got.
I don't think they think about it anymore. I think the thing is they just really enjoy having a fight, don't they? And they're kind of high on their own importance. Yeah. And then they get onto Newsnight, they get onto radio programmes. We're all taking them seriously again. That's what they want, because actually they're going to be irrelevant after the election if they don't get their act together.
It's like Brexit all over again. No, it isn't. It isn't. Brexit was like a huge thing. We're going to decide the direction of the country.
And it had been voted for.
And it had been voted for.
Yeah.
It was, democracy was at stake.
Yes. They were trying to impose the will of the people on a parliament that didn't want to.
And I just think some sectors of the lobby and some sectors of the Tory party need to calm down and stop putting Marc Francois.
Yeah. Marc Francois. He's
a political titan, and he needs to, and I think
he needs
probably,
to go to the Caribbean, really, doesn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, I think he'll probably sort it all out.
You know what? They could put them all on a plane to the Caribbean, couldn't they? And then they could calm down in the Caribbean. They could all get on in the sunshine, and it would be cheaper than us having to sort out Rwanda.
Perfect. Yeah, don't put anyone on a plane to Rwanda. Just put Marc Francois on the plane to the Caribbean.
Precisely.
Yeah. That would be like when the sort of 70s sitcoms used to have a Christmas special, they went on holiday.
Yeah.
There's all the same characters.
Yeah.
Yeah, round and round. Marc Francois
striding around the pool going, morning!
Yeah. It was usually Western Supermare or somewhere. It wasn't the Caribbean.
There's a very good one Only Fools and Horses, where they go on holiday and Rodney's supposed to be like a 14-year-old boy who's won a competition.
Yeah.
So he has to go to all the kids' clubs.
And it's all the guys in the pub go on a coach tour, don't they?
Yeah. Nice.
With hilarious consequences.
Well, that's all we need. Let's put them all on a bus to Western Supermare. Now, talking of children and people not acting their age, I thought this was really interesting. As a YouGov survey, they've basically spotted lots of people when they can't think of about anything else to write about in newspapers and magazines. I don't feel like a grown-up, when they're in their 30s or 40s, whatever. So they've polled, do you feel like a grown-up? And 34% of 18 to 24-year-olds don't feel like a grown-up. I think that's all right.
A
third. You know, just at university and living at home or whatever. You know.
Yeah, and the other ones are kidding themselves.
Yeah, and then 25 to 49-year-olds, that's a big old chunk, 28% don't feel like grown-ups.
Yeah.
Among 50 to 64-year-olds, 15% don't feel like grown-ups.
Mm.
And amongst the over 65s, 6% don't feel like grown-ups.
I guess it depends on your definition of your image of the word grown-up, doesn't it?
Do you feel like a grown-up, Robert?
Like I say, it depends on your definition. Yeah. And a grown-up, in many ways I do. And I suppose that happened to me when you have children, because you're responsible for somebody else. So I was 32. Prior to that, maybe not. Mm. In other respects, I don't feel that much different to how I felt when I was 35.
Yeah.
But then I was also, I think I was fairly grown up in some ways when I was 14, not emotionally, but in other ways I was. So who knows? I mean, I suppose people are trying to define themselves against a negative image of a grown up as being a sort of pipe and slippers.
Your parents are your grown-ups, or you're
some way clapped out, and that's what people are rebelling against.
It's also kind of who you're with, isn't it? Because I feel like a grown-up most of the time, but if I'm with my siblings, we all revert to being like
80. Yeah, that's a good point.
So there is a point when you're like, you do change, don't you? I think that's part of it. And ones I feel sorry for, the ones who are sort of 25 to 35 who aren't feeling like a grown-up, and that's because they're at home still and, you know, widding their washing. And the reason they're at home is because they can't afford a house or a flat or a...
Comment pieces come from is this idea that people thought that by 18 or 21 or 25 or 30 or 35, they would be
well. That's grown gone.
Up.
Yeah, that's gone out the window. I mean, I think maybe historically that was the anomaly that you left home at 18 and you didn't go back. Because previously people had grown up in and stayed near, you know, in or around their extended family, and that's kind of starting to happen again. And I think that's rather. I've written about this. I like it.
Yeah.
You know, and the kind of post-war two or three generations where you didn't do that. And you kind of moved out straight away, presumably because you could the housing was affordable. Was a little bit weird in some ways.
But it does infantilise you in some ways, doesn't it? I mean, that's the problem, is that you're used to living in quite a nice place. You've got your place, like when you're watching TV, you all sit in the same place.
My kids are still at home. They're 24 and 26, and the way they behave at home, it amazes me that they then go out and do proper jobs. You know what I mean? They've both got responsible jobs, and you think, well, how do they function given that they are sort of like. Kind of 12-year-olds at home.
But maybe that's a good thing, I think. I think it's actually quite, you know...
They can let off steam,
Yeah, I quite like it with my siblings when I literally revert to being eight and it's like, you know, who's taken my ex, why?
Yeah.
Particularly that.
Oh, we were talking about this at the Christmas thing, weren't we? You and your sister and the lilt thing.
Yeah, we see all sorts of things, jokes that you then have that then get nicked by them. And you just, you know, having been quite adult all year...
Yeah.
Yeah, when I ever see my brother, I just regress back to just relentlessly taking the mickey out of him.
Yeah.
And everyone else, the rest of his family, find that all quite entertaining because they like to see him being brought,
of course,
you know, down,
yeah.
And then he just, you know, starts to get me in a headlock.
Yeah, it's the British way, isn't it? Banter and a little bit of violence at the end.
This is Chris says, none of us ever grow up. We just learn how to behave in public.
Yeah,
I think it's important not to lose.
That is what growing up is, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but to not take too. Exactly. Yeah. But to know that you're just behaving in public.
Yeah.
Ella in Leeds says, I've just turned 70. And I still feel as silly as ever.
Yeah,
not for you. Not being a grown up is letting the old man in. No, being a grown up.
Yeah,
no, not yet.
I get what she's saying, Ella.
Yeah.
I think that's people rebelling against that, and by and large, I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, but I think growing up is actually paying taxes and things like that, isn't it? I mean, that's what you don't get when you're younger.
Yeah.
You're going to have to start doing all that kind of stuff.
And responsibility, knowing things are on you rather than
insurance,
somebody else.
Insurance, things like that.
Yeah.
And actually being, I suppose, that dependency thing of whether you're still living at home or not, but a sense that if something goes wrong, if your washing machine stops working, are you going to buy your washing machine or is someone else going to buy your washing machine?
Yeah. And you get that. I mean, obviously the ultimate of that is having a child and you get them home from the hospital and you look at each other and you think, oh, right, okay, right, this is on us now.
Well, I even remember when when our daughter was born, my wife had been taken out of the room, and so I was just left literally holding the baby.
Yeah.
It was very exciting.
Yeah.
And then the midwife said, should we put a nappy on her? And I was like, yeah, okay.
You crack on.
Yeah, if you like. She said, no.
Exactly. The first of
You'll
many.
You'll be doing that. Yeah.
The first of many,
You suddenly think, oh, blimey, yeah.
Yeah, oh, blimey, yeah.
Yeah.
So that is, I suppose, that's the other thing that people used to do. I mean, the average age of becoming a parent
now
is
30. Maybe that's the other thing.
You're older, aren't you?
Yeah, and it used to be 20, so.
Because you haven't got your own house and you haven't got your own money and you can't meet anyone because everyone on the internet's a sex pest.
And you can't really crack up if you've got children in quite the same way. You can't have a tantrum.
But also, the other thing is too much choice. In the old days, people didn't have, it wasn't arranged marriage exactly, but it wasn't that far off it.
Yeah.
You married people because you met them at the local dance or the farmers, or whatever.
Ours really young. We're different.
Yeah, we did.
I mean, we were really young.
Yeah, we are unusual in that respect.
Yeah, we're now on our 20th wedding anniversary.
Yeah, same here. And people our age. And then you're younger than us. It's endless. Oh dear, is there something better going to come along? Because you've just got the whole kind of world to choose from.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily a wonderful thing.
I think it's interesting. Mike says, I think being a grown up basically crystallizes when you start going to funerals regularly.
I think that's being old.
Anyway, great show.
Yeah,
I think that's a different thing we're talking about there, Mike.
Yeah.
When you're filling your days with wake food.
Yeah.
Which is always a lovely spread.
Always
a lovely spread. Robert, we need to talk about your biceps.
Do we?
Why are your biceps in the paper?
Because a guy called Andrew Scott, who people will know as the hot priest, an actor,
the hot priest
in Fleabag. I'm not sure. I think he looks a bit like Ant out of Ant and Dec. But anyway, gay men and women think otherwise. And he's made a new film in which basically it seems to be about his biceps.
Yeah.
Because he's pumped up his guns, as they're known. And so my boss being my boss told me yesterday, within about a minute, I found myself having to take my shirt off and be photographed and write about my own biceps.
I think the objectification of Robert Crampton's gone too far. Although they are a great set of...
They're good, aren't they?
Great set Cheers. Of guns.
Yeah, thank you.
That's probably the most read piece today.
Do you, in the privacy of your own home, occasionally kiss them?
No.
Okay.
No, I think that... No. No, I mean, it is... No, it's sort of...
Popeye, basically, isn't it?
Yeah. No, he was forearms, wasn't he?
How do you do it? Do you go to the gym to do it? Have you got dumbbells at home?
I haven't got any dumbbells at home. No, I go to the gym two or three times a week, and I have done for 3 years. And that, and you know, yeah, you've got to do something, and that's the result.
I've got absolutely no upper body strength at all.
Oh,
none at all. That's because I don't do anything.
No,
bit of light typing.
Yeah, does it bother you?
Only if I'm hanging off something.
Yeah. Well, that's when I get the benefit. When, exactly. when I'm hanging off something, I really get the benefit. I can hang for 10 seconds longer than you can before I fall off.
Those monkey bars don't hang off themselves.
Yeah. It's competitive hanging.
Yeah.
We've had another one. Loads of people getting in touch about the way. Sheila says, I'm 82 and I'm still 18 on the inside. It's just the outside that lets me down.
Yeah.
This is nice. All our listeners are young at heart.
Yeah, exactly. Young as you feel. Young as you feel.
Well, that's what we all do with sport, don't we?
Yeah,
you go running. You kind of like I do my yoga to try and get bit because you want to look a bit younger. That's the thing.
I guess so.
And you just feel it. Well, you want to look how you feel, basically. Don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
I'd like to make clear I feel better than I look. I don't really do anything. I do a bit of jogging.
I think you look, but you look young, great, actually, mate. Yeah.
You look great.
I always get told if I've got the telly and I've makeup, great skin.
Yeah, great complexion. Great skin. Do you moisturise?
I do moisturise every day.
Yeah.
I think it's the West Country rain as well, isn't
I think I once somebody, I remember like reading one of those articles about how you should start moisturising in your 20s, so I did.
Excellent advice. I think Sakia
Don't say this because I'll end up having to write a piece.
Sakia moisturises, I think. He's 62.
Yeah, he does look good on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, David Cameron's got that very kind of...
He looks like he's been polished by those carpet... Yeah. You know those industrial ones?
Circular ones. Like parquet floor?
Yeah, he looks like he's been buffed every morning by that. Yeah, exactly. Excellent sound effect.
Or you could have had Botox, Matt. We just don't know.
We just don't know. All questions that we...
Your eyebrows aren't really moving, I don't think.
I've not had Botox. I thought you were talking about David.
I have had Botox.
Of course you have, because that was for a piece.
Yeah.
Ho, ho, ho! Merry Christmas!
Now, should you discuss politics with the family over the festive period? And can you do it without it turning into a massive festive punch-up? I'm joined by the UK's leading etiquette coach, William Hanson's here. Hi, William.
Hello, Matt. Thank you for having me.
No, it's good to have you back. Good to have you back. What are your top tips for Alice and Robert when discussing politics over Christmas?
Well, they've said it. We do all sort of regress into our old roles within families. The dynamics that might have existed in our childhood basically come back to the surface. I would also say, is it worth it? If you have completely different views of certain members of family, Christmas is meant to be a happy time. And it's sort of, I think it's sticking your finger in the conversational plug if you know that what your opinion on whatever the topic is going to be controversial. Christmas isn't the time or place.
Yet you say that, William, sometimes winding up your Brexity uncle is irresistible.
Well, yes, and you might take great satisfaction from it, but if it affects the general mood of the room, I would say perhaps that do it another time.
What about if it's something really serious, William, like somebody says something racist?
Oh, good point.
Yeah, you can absolutely call someone out. And my top tip would be, as step one, before you go completely nuclear on them, I would sort of just say, sorry, could you just repeat that? And just ask them to repeat it, because 80% of the time they might backtrack and go, oh, no, well, no, what I meant was I didn't mean it like that. And they sort of correct themselves. Crisis averted. If, of course, they continue down an ist theme, then you can, of course, if writer's on your side, you can absolutely go and get out.
Did you notice the way William said thank you for having me, by the way?
Yes, I thought that.
Very polite. He's not a leading etiquette expert.
No, for nothing.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yes, thank you.
That's very important.
Thank you,
William, what is the thing that people do at Christmas that you hate the most?
I don't like I don't like most people's decorations, but I also don't I don't like where the Christmas meal, whether it's a lunch or a dinner, is this. It's wasted in a no man's land, and it's sort of at 3:34. Either have it at lunchtime, which is 1 o'clock, or have it at dinner time, sort of 7 o'clock-ish. Don't sort of have it in the middle of the day where it's got an identity crisis.
Cool. I agree with that.
That's a good point.
Yeah, yeah. That's good.
Yeah. Yeah, but my problem is it's not like the political arguments we're having. It's like, did you steal my drainpipe jeans circa 1978 or something?
Oh, yeah.
And that can get quite heavy. What do you do then?
It's also really pretty soluble, isn't it?
Yeah.
William, what do you do if, for instance, you've got some young people in the house who are vegans and what you really want is a dirty great big turkey?
Look, if you know you've got vegans, vegetarians, etc. coming, then really everyone's dietary requirements should be accommodated, and they also should have told you, if you're the host, in advance that they have that dietary requirement. There's no point in them turning up. But look, you know, it is part of modern etiquette now. Everyone has dietary requirements. In the old days, it was a lot easier because people just used to die. But now you have to ask, and that's probably a good thing.
Excellent. Where will you be spending Christmas, William?
I shall be with my family in Bristol.
Lovely.
Yeah.
There we are. Is that right? William, are you related to our Hanson?
Yes, he is. Is he still your Prime Minister?
Yeah, he's still the Prime Minister on the quiz.
Yes, I'm the Prime Minister's brother.
There we are. Well, it all comes together. James Hanson off of Times Radio.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there we are. Well, it all comes together. William, lovely to speak to you again, and Merry Christmas.
Happy Christmas to all of you.
William, we should get you to do the quiz. That's what we should
do. Oh, no, I'd be terrible.
No, it'd be good. They get the brothers up against each other, fighting at Christmas. Yeah.
That's Christmas, isn't it?
Yeah. Happy Christmas.
See how much etiquette they've got there.
Alice Thompson and Robert Crampton there. And, of course, you can read them both in The Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next is PMQ's Unpacked.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast now. It's time for this.
PMQs Unpacked on Times Radio. Unpacking the politics and cutting through the crossfire.
Order, order. I call Matt Chorley. And Tim Shipman.
And Tim Shipman is here for the last one of the year. Chief Political Commentator of the Sunday Times. Tim, how are you?
I'm very well indeed. That's pretty telling, that, isn't it? You know, the numbers for them both. We've got two sort of not very exciting people about to contest this who are viewed quite negatively by the public. One of them is going to be our Prime Minister next year for probably a protracted period of time. Now is the moment. Seize the day. Set the agenda as we go into the Christmas break.
And as it's the last one of the year, she's back. Ayesha Hazarika, off of Times Radio.
Hello.
You're here to guide us through and hopefully educate us in the structure of a Keir Starmer joke.
Come on, that's a bit... It's a bit nasally,
I mean,
isn't it?
You wrote them for Ed Miliband. I mean, surely.
That went well.
Now, if you weren't listening last week, I've just put it in. We've got a little roundup of some of Keir Starmer's jokes from last week. Let's just take a listen to some of these.
I would say that this treaty's got more holes in than a Swiss cheese, but I don't want to wind up the Prime Minister by talking about a European country again. Forget the private jet. He's on sort of a private planet of his own. From up yours, Delors, to take our money, Kigami.
Sorry, that's so bad. It's funny.
That last one got you. It was weird, though, last week, Ayesha, because he was quite good for three questions, really zeroing in on the detail that this Rwanda plan isn't going anywhere. Even if it does, it's only 100 people. What's the point of all of that? And then it just fell apart.
Yeah, then he sort of went into the sort of Uber band. And, of course, the week before, he'd had that really good PMQs. I think probably his best one yet. And I think very rarely does PMQs really cut through. But I think that week was a week that cut through because it spoke to a truth. I think what's happened, and I see this a lot with politicians, is that at the beginning, they're really nervous about making jokes. And particularly like someone like Keir, who, you know, I know quite well, is a very, very nice guy. He's not Mr. Giggles, right, in terms of like Uber. He's not the Archbishop of Banterbury, right, put it that way. But I think once you get the kind of thrill of a couple of jokes that go well for you in the chamber, you can get a little bit addicted to it. And I think sometimes there's a bit of sort of overreach. The other thing, which is fair to say, even though us outside are like, oh, it was like a groan-a-thon, like in the chamber, God loves a trier. And I think, like, you know, your side, particularly Labour side, just gets so cheery. If someone makes some effort, some semblance of a joke, they just kind of really go with it.
Mr. Giggle sounds a bit like a slightly sinister children's toy, doesn't it? That might have been popular in the 80s, but would be inappropriate now.
Children's entertainer who hasn't passed his DBS check.
Yes.
That's what I was thinking.
Who smells faintly of booze.
There was a poll running online. Who should write Keir Starmer's jokes? Ayesha, Matt, Tim or Lara? Ayesha is just edging ahead.
Oh.
You can get online and vote on that.
It's hardly fair. You're both stand-up comedians, so
that's very kind of you to say so, Tim.
Well, I've watched you both do stand-up.
And that is his entirely factual review.
That was his ringing endorsement. That's actually when you do a gig and you come off and someone goes, how do you think that went then?
Yeah.
No, you actually both are sort of try to be funny and are, whereas I just do sort of speeches where people are pleasantly surprised if you say anything amusing. So,
and you probably get paid a lot more.
I would say a lot more money than we've made at our gigs. Right, here we go. Then let's find out. Has Keir Starmer been at the joke book again for the last time in 2023? We go live to the House of Commons for PMQs Unpacked. This is Keir Starmer.
Yesterday we heard of the tragic death of a young man on the Bibby Stockholm. I know the whole House will want to send our deepest condolences to his family and friends. We must never let this happen again. Yeah. I would also like to mark the retirement of my colleague and friend, Mark Drakeford, the First Minister of Wales. Yeah. Mark committed his life to public service and lives his values every day. Quietly and patiently, Mark has been a titan of Labour and Welsh politics, and we thank him for his service and wish him well. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, Christmas is a time of peace on earth and goodwill to all. Has anyone told the Tory party?
Uh-oh.
Here we go.
It's bold. I like the ambition.
Mr. Speaker, Christmas is also a time for families. And under the Conservatives, we do have a record number of them, Mr. Speaker.
That's a joke. That's a five families joke.
Mr. Speaker, but it's important. At the beginning of the year, I set out some priorities that this government would deliver for the British people. And over the course of this year, we have, Mr. Speaker, inflation halved, Mr. Speaker, the economy growing, debt falling, action on the longest waiters, the boats down by a third, and crucially, as we heard from Honourable Friend, tax cuts coming to help working families in the new year.
Right, let's just pause it there and just get our breath back. Quite the gear shift from a death on the Bibby Stockholm, Mark Drakeford's resignation.
And I love the tribute to Mark Drakeford, quietly getting... this is a man who obviously is incapable of speaking excitingly in public and has been quietly doing his job in a way that no one ever noticed. But well done him.
Well done him.
I'm disappointed he didn't mention Caerphilly cheese.
Caerphilly, that was the only thing that everyone knows about Mark Drakeford, is a big fan of Caerphilly cheese. Christmas is a time for goodwill, peace on earth and goodwill to all men. How's it going in the Tory party?
At that point, we were all looking at each other going, oh, here we go, the joke placard goes up. Look, that is pretty standard fare. I think that's not a bad opening, you know, bit of knockabout. Everyone at Christmas expects some really bad Christmas jokes. There's a whole kind of, there'll be a whole range of ugly sisters, grim brothers, all that sort of thing. It was fine. I mean,
I'll give
like,
him 5.2. He's just the right side of the line.
Yeah, kind of had to go in.
Also, it rings true. It's a sort of thing that he might have thought of himself.
Yeah. And it was really short.
And it was nice and short.
Authentically dad joke, is what you're saying, essentially.
Rishi Sunak saying, you know, Christmas is also a time for families, and in the Tory party we've got a lot of them. That's a five families
joke. That's actually a good joke.
It's not bad. It's Marc Francois and his weird five families godfather thing. Although everyone seems to be in all of the families.
John Hayes is very prolific, is in at least three of the five families, which means there may be a bit of interbreeding going on somewhere.
It's feeling a bit Mormon, isn't
but
it?
But as the Times leader pointed out this morning, five factions on one wing of the Tory party.
Yeah.
Maybe one or two too many if you're going to achieve anything. And last night they didn't.
Well, I want to just stick up for Rishi Sunak at this point and just say, actually, sometimes it's very good to anticipate an attack and own it. So I think he gets a point for that. Fairly.
And then taking the dad joke and just using an excuse to rattle through your pledges. So half inflation, economy growing.
I'm going to make a prediction. That may not be the last we hear.
The economy is not growing,
though,
as we discovered this morning. It shrunk in October. I'm not sure the debt is falling. And he's now saying he's focusing on the longest waiters in the NHS.
Action on the longest waiters, which makes it sound a bit like he's personally going around and telling them, get out of your beds so you're no longer waiting.
But again, that's slightly shifting from cutting waiting lists, because that's not altogether. And then some talk of tax cuts. So we've set the tone. This feels like knockabout end of year stuff.
Definitely. I know as well that Rwanda's economy is growing faster than ours.
Well, I'm not surprised at all the money
we've given them. Yeah. All those new houses that have gone up, and you know.
Everyone's having a swimming pool.
I mean,
no NIMBYs in Rwanda.
Just what Suella Braverman spent on Toblerones at Kigali Airport is probably keeping that economy going. Right, let's go back to the House of Commons. This is question two from Keir Starmer.
Mr. Speaker, he can spin it all he likes, but the whole country can see that yet again, the Tory party is in meltdown and everyone else is paying the price. Now, he kicked the can down the road. But in the last week, his MPs have said of him, he's not capable enough. He's inexperienced. He's arrogant. A really bad politician. Well, they're shouting. This is what they said. So, well, come on. Who was it who said he's a really bad politician? Hands up.
Well, I know, because it was in my piece.
They're shouting.
Well, this has gone
what
proper
about inexperienced? Panto. Who was that? Or, and now there's got to be some hands for this, he's got to go. Oh, shy. Apparently, he's holding a Christmas party next week.
Order.
It's Christmas. No, the Christmas. But you might not want the Christmas present that I could give you. So please, here's Lama.
Lindsay Hall, they're really cutting
apparently
and ruining his flow.
Apparently he's holding a Christmas party next week. How's the invite list looking?
Oh, that would have been better if it hadn't been for Lindsay Hall.
Mr. Speaker, I thank the honourable gentleman for all the comments. What I would say to him, he should hear what they have to say about him, Mr. Speaker.
It's not bad.
No. That's so weak. That's basically like your mum.
It is a bit like in between us.
Is he sat down again? Was that it? That was the full extent of his response. They should hear what they say about him. Wow.
Yeah, that's full on Badoola Newman from, yeah. You know, your
that's,
mum.
That's you, that is.
That's you, that is.
You smell. See yeah. that thing on the floor? That
said,
is.
What is the purpose here today is to, for a guy who's had a pretty unutterably awful couple of weeks and it looked like the stool might be being kicked out from under his swinging neck last night. He survived that. He just wants them to go home to Christmas and worry about their Toblerones rather than whether he's still their Prime Minister. And there was quite a big cheer for that really appallingly bad response. Tories have a low humour quotient.
Just
threshold, I would say.
Just remind us, the person who called him useless and arrogant had to go in your piece, was that an unnamed person or a named person?
Unnamed member of the cabinet.
Right.
Gosh, that doesn't narrow it down, does it?
No.
But just in terms of that hands-up thing, that is such a sort of classic device that I remember we loved doing that with Ed, because everyone slightly does get confused. It's just such a sort of, it's a sort of slightly rubbish device, but it does cause enough, because there's always some sort of pudding who does put their hand up because they think it's a sort of, you have to put your hand up. So that is just a slightly pantomine thing that.
But he did it quite well. He had a bit, he seemed sort of bit
of swagger.
A bit of swagger.
Bit of swagger.
His face was a bit Widow Twanky, though, I would say.
There are times when, particularly when Keir Starmer's got his glasses on, he does look a bit like he could be like the Gran in Little Red Riding Hood.
Or Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yes, it's real Mrs. Doubtfire.
Little
vibe.
Kind of. But you're right, he is enjoying himself. He's what an optic. What
now,
an optic.
There's a challenge. Yeah. We got a Zippy on. Can you get Mrs. Doubtfire
on? Yeah, get John O'Farrell.
Well, the guy from the live.
Yeah.
Let's do that. Can we get Mrs. Doubtfire in? Right, very good. Let's go back to the House of Commons. I'm glad we're taking all this as seriously as they are. This is question three from Keir Starmer.
They've obviously found the donkey for their nativity. The search of three wise men may take a little longer. But while they fight amongst themselves, there's a country out here that isn't being governed, where more than 100,000 people are paying hundreds more a month on their mortgages. Energy bills going back up in January. The economy shrinking again. NHS waiting lists an all-time high. Doesn't he think the government would be better off fixing the messes they've already made rather than scrambling to create new ones?
Mr. Speaker, he talks about governing and spent the first two questions talking about political tittle-tattle, Mr. Speaker. Well, let's get on to the substance, Mr. Speaker. Let's get on to the substance. He mentioned the things. What is the news that we've just heard in the last week? Well, what's the most important thing? The most important thing is education, Mr. Speaker, because that's how we spread opportunity in our country. And what have we learned? Where are the schools performing best in the United Kingdom? In England, Mr. Speaker, thanks to the reforms of this Conservative government, rising up the league tables, giving our kids the start they need. And where are they plummeting down? In Labour-run Wales.
Oh, poor Mr. Drakeford.
It's a good point, though. I mean, it's an interesting question as to whether, you know, given that, you know, Keir Starmer boasts on the record now having ousted Richard Leonard in Scotland because he was seen as a roadblock to the making.
Too Corbynite,
and basically being a bit useless. But Mark Drakeford's record in Wales, in terms of the attacks that the Tories can make, isn't great, whether it's on schools, NHS waiting lists, the row over 20 miles per hour.
Well, he was being very quiet. He should have shouted a bit louder by the sound of it.
But you know what I mean? So in terms of going into a general election next year, not having Drakeford there and a new person who can say, oh, well, nothing to do with us, but turning things around, it does remove some of the sting.
You're definitely going to... I mean, that's a Tory pivot, right? You're going to see Tories pivoting to Wales. I mean, they didn't mention Scotland, but I'm sure that will come up when Stephen Flynn stands up. He will use that again as a rejoinder and say, because the Scottish education system has really plummeted as well. But what I thought was... I thought the donkey thing from Keir Starmer was pretty good, but what's very interesting was watching Keir Starmer clearly wanting to pivot back to the economy and cost of living, because the Tories and certainly Reform want to make this a sort of immigration election. Mm. And Labour has spent a lot of time talking about immigration because of Rwanda. They don't really want to be doing that. They want everything to pivot back to cost of living. So I thought it was quite interesting pivot from Keir Starmer there.
And also, you know, that line, why don't you fix the mess that you've made rather than scrambling to create another one? That feels like something that, you know, could even be a line lifted from a focus group. There's sort of like, you know, there's enough problems already. Why are they having this sort of bun fight? Interesting as well, Rishi Sunak now declaring education the most important thing. Not something we've ever really heard from him.
Well,
yet.
He always sort of says that, but he's never really done very much
about
it.
But it's not one of his top five pledges.
No.
No great education reform, apart from some vague idea about doing maths till 18.
And let's not forget, we just had the nightmare of, like, sending your little darling in school wearing a crash helmet in case, like, a bit of the ceiling fell down on them. So, yeah.
We'll put some tinsel around
it. I mean, whisper it quietly. It may suit both the Tories and Labour to have an argument about the economy rather than about immigration, because, as you say, that doesn't help the Tories with reform. And if Sunak can get in a position early in the year where he says, look, these tax cuts are beginning to come through, the economy's turning around. They always were expecting a little blip in GDP this month, with it improving again next month. That might... You know, Labour can say we'd spend the money better than you and we care about this, this and this that you don't care about. And they may, you know, the best, most plausible election argument for the Tories is we're slightly turning the corner, don't let Labour go and screw it up. So it may suit them both to get onto that terrain, ultimately.
And there are really interesting dividing lines against them both on, you know, education's one area where Labour has got something interesting to say about it, controversial VAT on private schools. So, you know they'd be quite happy. Bridget,
yeah, whereas on immigration, it's not working for the Tories and Labour doesn't really have a policy. And that's sort but of, not, so, it's but a pretty arid area.
Tories I speak to are really frustrated. They don't talk about their education record more. They're actually the growing up the PISA things, and a lot of it actually, because it takes so long, dates back to this
reforms that Michael Gove did. 2010, isn't it?
And Nick Gibb,
he did a good job of that. Who got bumped off at the reshuffle. Right, let's go back then. This is what question number four from Keir Starmer.
He talks about children. Nearly 140,000 children are going to be homeless this Christmas. Yeah. That is more than ever before. That's a shocking state of affairs, and it should shame this government. Instead of more social housing, house building is set to collapse. Instead of banning no-fault evictions, thousands of families are at risk of homelessness. Rather than indulging his backbenchers, swanning around in their factions and their star chambers, pretending to be members of the mafia, when's he going to get a grip and focus on the country?
Let's just look at the facts. Let's look at the facts, actually, because rough sleeping in this country is down by 35%, Mr. Speaker, since its peak, thanks to the efforts of this government. There are hundreds of thousands of fewer children in poverty today, thanks to this government, Mr. Speaker. And when it comes to home building, again, what are you doing? We just had the data this last week. In the last year, an almost record number of new homes delivered, Mr. Speaker. More than in any year of the last Labour government.
It's interesting how Keir Starmer has actually managed to pull this off. Like, sarky joke.
He's now turned into attack line.
Attack line.
Yeah.
Pretending to be members of the mafia, mucking about. This is a serious business. I mean, the hilarious thing about this five families mafia joke is that it was invented by a reporter for Mail Online and then embraced by the people in the mafia families who thought, oh, that's hilarious.
Without realising it, in the film, they all kill each other.
Yeah, and those of us old enough to remember when the senior people in the ERG started referring to themselves as the Grand Wizards, who, of course, used to run the Ku Klux Klan. Remember how these things can backfire sometimes, the sort of self-image of these people.
But in terms of the structure of that, Aisha, what Keir Starmer is doing is he's getting the joke in, but then by pivoting to 140,000 children at homeless this Christmas, he's sort of denying Rishi Sunak the opportunity to come back with a joke.
Yeah, and I actually think it's a structure that's really working for him, and it's very reminiscent for me, having prepared going up against him, of William Hague. Actually, William Hague used to do, that was quite a tactic he used to do, where he would actually not just run on the same theme, he would go on different topics, but he would kind of get a joke in early, which made it very, very difficult to respond. I think it's really interesting that Starmer's chosen homelessness and child homelessness. That does work for him in a number of areas. It signals some left-wing credentials to bits of his movement that are feeling a bit bruised after the Thatcher comments and things like that. It's a bit of kind of sort of all-time religion for the Labour side of things. Also, Sunak is on kind of ropey ground on this because he can say, look, the rough sleeping figures have gone down. That is not how it feels in the country.
But also, that is actually a different thing. So these figures are 140,000 children living in temporary accommodation, so without a home.
It's a classic Sunak response, isn't it? Look at me, I know the numbers.
you know, everything's fine. In sleeping bags under. He's talking about something which is a bit near what also, we are, but not quite.
Strange ground to go on when his Home Secretary recently said that sleeping rough is a lifestyle choice. So, but that is very much, you know, that Starmer again. I think that is him using PMQs quite strategically so that his people can say to the left of his party, look, he does care about these issues as well, the issues that we know you care about, the social justice issues.
I'm going to say so far, so good.
Yeah.
The jokes aren't terrible. Interesting attack lines, but then Rishi Sunak pivot. Somebody just texted in saying, stop saying pivot.
Sorry, Richard.
Anyway, but Rishi Sunak pivoting to whatever it is that he wants to talk about. You know, they're both, you know... And if the aim of the game is sending your troops home with a spring in your step, they're both probably doing all right on that test.
They're both
far.
Above their usual average, I would say.
Yeah, which is pretty bad. It's Matt Chorley on Times Radio with Tim Shipman and Aisha Azarika, bringing you PMQs Unpacked live on Times Radio and on the Times Radio YouTube channel, so you can watch along as well, so you can see their faces and ours, if that's what you want while you're having your lunch. Let's go back to the comments. It's question five from Keir Starmer.
140,000 children homeless this Christmas, and he's utterly tone deaf. Yes. And the rise in homelessness shows how these Tory crises merge and grow and damage the country. Yep. Families like the Bradys in Wiltshire, both parents working full-time with two young children, forced out of their home of 15 years by a no-fault eviction, now living in their van. Or 11-year-old Liam Walker, homeless this Christmas. He wrote a letter to Santa saying, please can I have a forever home? I don't want any new toys. I just want all my old toys out of storage. I just want us to be happy again. Is there anything that could shame this government into putting the country first? Then it's surely this little boy.
Yeah. Mr. Speaker, if he really cared about building homes... If he really cared about building homes, when there was an opportunity in this House, Mr. Speaker, in this House, to back our plans to reform defective EU laws, to unlock 100,000 new homes, Mr. Speaker, what did he do? What did he do? He went in front of the cameras and said one thing and came in here and blocked it. Typical shameless opportunism.
Wow.
Wow.
I mean,
that escalated.
Quite. And this, you know, I was talking yesterday to people who are potential rebels on this Rwanda stuff. They went to see the Prime Minister. And where some of them sort of went away happy, a lot of them didn't, because they felt that he was just sort of riding roughshod and saying, I'm right. And when I've got a strong opinion about where I'm right, you can all go hang. And that was just a classic example of a bad answer at the beginning. You know, I mean, maybe his side will give him some points for the way it concluded. But where was the counter story? Where was the... I know families like that in my own constituency.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'll tell you what helped them out. It was when we were able to build this or do that or whatever it was he wants to claim credit for. And you try and humanise your own side of the argument.
Yeah.
And then you can hit him back with, and by the way, we did try to build some more homes and you didn't. But when you come across... in the face of a sort of emotive question with a shrill response that basically says, I'm going to completely ignore what you've said and then have a pop at you. Starmer's right. It is tone deaf. And that's one of the things that Tory MPs find difficult to swallow about Rishi Sunak. He's a terribly clever bloke, but he hasn't learned how to sound like a human being.
I wonder, because somebody was... we were talking about this, I think maybe on the show yesterday or earlier in the week, Aisha, because people go from, you know... newly elected backbench MP to now Prime Minister in such record time, they don't sort of build up that sort of back catalogue of, you know, anecdote and experience so that when you find yourself in a sticky situation, and maybe, you know, Rishi Sunak bluntly didn't spend years on the backbenches watching other people make these mistakes and learning from them. Very quickly, he was on the front bench himself. Actually, there was an answer to that question that was, you know, this very sad story, and I read that story in the Mirror myself, and, you know, my heart go, I'm sure hearts go out to them, and we have done this and this, but there's always more to do. We could all work together, but you know, when we did bring that, you know, there's just a
absolutely.
That is a choice.
Yeah.
The way he's chosen to answer that question.
I mean, I think Tim's used the right phrase. It's tone deaf, and I think what Rishi Sunak really struggles with is sometimes just being able to read the room and kind of read the mood of where things were. I mean, Keir Starmer didn't make a sort of jokey comment there. That he was going straight in for the heartstrings, the human story. You could picture that wee boy. And you're right, there's loads of places Sunak could have come back on. In fact, if I was Sunak and I was advising him, I'd say, look, what that boy needs and what his family needs more than anything is a really stable economy. We know we need to be able to, you know, you could do what he doesn't need. It is sort of recklessness. Or you could do a whole thing like that. But to start yelling essentially about a measure which was allowing house builders to pump chemicals into rivers, it is such a sort of stretch. But to your point, Matt, I always remember, you know, speaking to older like Labour backbenchers when prepping Ed for PMQs and speaking to lots of people in the Lords as well who'd been former MPs. And you're right. Many people in the front bench now don't have that apprenticeship on the back benches where they even spend time sort of sitting, looking at how the craft of the Commons works, you know, how you ask the right questions, what are the different sort of cadences of questions, what are the different moods in the sort of chamber. And I think you forget Rishi Sunak's really inexperienced. His team is really inexperienced as well. You know, his political secretary was a journalist for The Spectator like 5 minutes ago. He hasn't got a lot of kind of seasoned, gnarly people around him who could say, look, sometimes you've got to take it down a bit. You know, sometimes it's generally when I've prepped people, and you know, I've prepped prime ministers as well, Gordon Brown and Harriet when she was acting for Gordon. What you have to do is you often judge you match your response to the tone of the question.
Yeah.
You know, so if someone comes hard at you, you go hard back at them. If someone comes in with a more human interest, you take it down a bit. Whereas he sort of not understood that.
I remember there was once somebody asked Gordon Brown how much it cost to fill a car with petrol, and he started talking about barrels of oil. And that was a similar sort of detachment between, you know, what was a very retail thing. People pointed out, but he doesn't drive because he can't, you know, because of his eyes. But you know, that you do need to match those two things. Well, let's see if it gets any better in the final stages then. Their last set two of 2023. This is question six from Keir Starmer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As the world's...
One more.
Mr. Speaker, is that really his Christmas message to Liam? Cocooned in his party management breakfast. He just can't see the...
Order. Mr. Cleverly, please. It's Christmas. I want a little bit of silence.
So that's James Cleverly, the Home Secretary, being told off.
I'm going to get it one way or another, and that goes to each side. Keir Starmer.
Cocooned in his party management breakfast, he just can't see the country in front of him and what they've done. I'll finish by thanking hard-working families across Britain who kept our country going. It's been an impossibly difficult year for so many. I want to pay special tribute to our key workers, particularly those in the emergency services and those serving abroad in our forces, who, even at this time of year, are doing the vital work of protecting their country. I wish everyone, including the members opposite, a very happy and peaceful New Year. Will the Prime Minister join me?
Prime Minister.
I think, Mr. Speaker, he missed that I paid tribute to our emergency workers at the beginning of the session, Mr. Speaker. But let's see. No, because I think it is important, because he talked about working families. Of course, Mr. Speaker, I want to make sure that we support working families, and that's what we're actually delivering, Mr. Speaker. Because all he has to offer them is borrowing £28 billion a year. Which all it will do is push up their mortgage rates and push up their taxes. Meanwhile, what have we done? Delivered tax cuts for millions of working families. Boosted the national living wage, Mr. Speaker. Recruited 50,000 more nurses. 20,000 more police officers. Improved our schools. We've cut the cost of net zero for those working families. We've cut the boat crossings by a third and we've halved inflation. And that's the difference, Mr. Speaker. We're getting on and delivering for working Britain.
I'm not sure if the charge was that he was tone deaf. I'm not sure that final answer. You know, but Keir Starmer basically dialed it right down. He basically just wanted to say Happy Christmas.
Yep. I mean, I, at the risk of making this about me, I've spent 6 years.
Surely not.
I have spent 6 years writing about the last 6-7 years of Tory politics. And I am bored of covering people who don't understand that politics is not just about policy. Mm. It's not just about delivery. It's about taking people with you and about convincing them of your argument. And so many of the people we have seen find that very difficult. Boris Johnson could kind of take people with him. He didn't know where he was going, and he often didn't get there. Theresa May didn't know where she was going and had no idea how to get there, and then was unable to take people with her even when she did work it out. Rishi Sunak kind of knows where he's going, but he seems totally incapable of taking anyone with him, including several factions of his own party. And that, I think, is what has been revealed, you know, big time today. And it was a game of two halves, but the other way around this week.
Yeah.
Starmer started well, but Sunak kind of dealt with it fine. And then he just turned into shrill, snippy Rishi. And I think he's made a horlicks of the last three questions.
Maybe there's something in last week when Keir Starmer went three questions serious, three jokey. He seemed to sort of lose the plot a bit. We're doing the jokey bit at the beginning and then getting more and more serious, which just denied Sunak any opportunity to laugh and like relax a bit. So instead, it was like the sort of pull the string in the back of the dummy. You know, just read out your targets. It's interesting, actually, some people on the YouTube channel saying that, you know, Starmer is using the attack lines he'd use in an election campaign. And Sunak's just basically saying everything is brilliant. That's not going to work with an electorate.
Well, our listeners are incredibly astute, because if you are smart and your strategists are smart, you use PMQs as a testing ground for your campaign slogans, which then come out in the short campaign. I remember hearing from David Cameron the phrase long-term economic plan again and again and again. And of course, that ended up being the sort of frame for their election. I just thought it was so revealing about how Rishi Sunak handled that last question. It clearly discombobulated him that Keir Starmer didn't do a massive attack. Normally, that last opportunity, that last question for both leaders is a chance to sort of dump on the other one. And Keir Starmer decided to kind of go statesman and thank the country. And I thought even Rishi Sunak's I did pay tribute, actually, right at the point of information. I think you'll find that.
On a point of order, Mr. Speaker.
I did actually.
I did actually say thank you to the nurses. And I'm not doing it again.
I wouldn't dream of saying it again. And, you know, that sort of pre-rehearsed dump, it also showed two things to me. A, he's not good at thinking on his feet, because he should at that point been able to sort of think, right, I'm actually going to rip this script up. I'm going to try and match the energy that I've just, you know, he could have said something really statesman like, look, it has been a very, very difficult year for and he could have made himself myself included. Yeah. But, you know, I thank him for his comments. I hope he and his family have a restful time. But I want people to know that over this Christmas, I'm going to be straining every sinew to come back. You know, we've got to, you know, do the right thing. He could have done a big do the right thing for the country. Yeah.
It's almost like you should have a career prepping senior politicians for this.
But it's really just getting under the bonnet of it, the mechanics of it, and the fact that actually some weeks he's terrible, but Keir Starmer's team this week, that the way they've used the ebb and flow and that business of just basically saying Happy Christmas at the end.
And it's playing the other guy as well, because they know how he responds to this stuff.
And just very quickly, but by kind of doing that thank you Britain question at the end, it's almost like not doing a question. Because sometimes the other trick you can do at PMQs as leader of the opposition is stop after five, and it really does the other person's head in, because they haven't done that. That means they can't do their dump on you.
Yeah, yeah.
So like he practically didn't do a question there and allowed himself to look statesmanlike, and it caught Rishi Sunak.
He asked him if he wanted to wish everybody a happy Christmas.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, Matt Chorley on Times Radio.
Very good afternoon to you. It's Matt Chorley on Times Radio. We've done PMQs, unpacked the key exchanges. Lara Spirit is watching the best of the rest. How was it, Lara?
It was good.
Yes! Finally!
I practice saying
very
that.
Very good. Was it good?
Yeah, I mean, it genuinely was interesting.
I just say that every week just to keep him quiet.
Well, exactly. No, I'm well advised. There were moments that were genuinely very interesting, yes.
And what are they? Where are we going first?
We're going, obviously, first to Stephen Flynn, SNP Westminster leader. And this question, ceasefire in Gaza, is raised. We haven't heard this in PMQs for a fair amount of time, or at least it hasn't led in the way that at the beginning of the conflict, from the recent conflict, it had. So I think it's worth listening to this. And it is it's a pretty punchy question from Stephen Flynn.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can the Prime Minister please share his Christmas message for children being bombed in Gaza?
this winter.
Prime Minister.
No.
Mr. Speaker, nobody wants to see this conflict go on for a moment longer than necessary. We urgently need more humanitarian pauses to get all the hostages out and to get life-saving aid into Gaza to alleviate the suffering of the Palestinian people. And we have been consistent that we support what is a sustainable ceasefire, which means Hamas must stop launching rockets into Israel and release all the hostages.
That was a punchy question. And again, yeah, in terms of the art of asking questions of PMQs, keeping it short is often better.
Yeah, and I mean, you heard the shouting that Rishi and I were subjected to there as well. And there was a question later on the crimes of sexual violence from Teresa Villiers, perpetrated by Hamas, that we've seen in reports, which Rishi Sunak answered to. So it was a PMQs from the backbenches where we did see a number of questions on that. But can I move on to the next one?
Yeah, where are we going next?
We are going to Sir Stephen Timms, who asks this question that I think a number of people have been asking since we saw that big announcement on legal migration at the beginning of last week. It feels like such a long time ago that now, but obviously actually semi-recently, on spousal salaries and the threshold needed to come here and the possibility, or indeed under the current system, the likelihood that many marriages might need to be, or weddings might need to be called off on account of this. And I think an interesting news line.
Well, the 38,000 is the new threshold.
And Rishi Sunak confirming here that, which I don't think we've heard before, at least I've certainly missed it, that there are transitional arrangements that the Home Office are coming to, are looking at the moment, that they're planning on announcing soon to make sure that those who are further down the line on this might actually still be able to marry the people they love. So have a listen to this question.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The marriage plans of thousands of couples were dashed last week by the sudden announcement of a big increase in the salary requirement for a spouse visa. Can the Prime Minister give any reassurance to those with very well advanced marriage plans which appear now to have been scuppered, and to families already in the UK who need to extend their stay who won't comply with the new rules? Can he at least offer some transitional help for families, or does his party's support for the family now only apply to the highly paid?
Well, Mr. Speaker, we have a long-standing principle that anyone bringing dependents to the UK must be able to support them financially. We should not expect this to be at the taxpayers' expense, and the threshold hasn't been raised in over a decade. It's right that we have now brought it in line with the median salary. The family immigration route, as he knows, does contain provision for exceptional circumstances, but more generally it's also right, and I can tell him, to look at transitional arrangements to ensure that they are fair, and the Home Office are actively looking at this and will set out further information shortly.
That's interesting. Transitional arrangements and looking at it, so it might not be quite such a
hard and sharp break that if you've already planned to come and get married here, you might not have to be calling it off. So I think that was one of the big moments in that big package of measures that were announced last week that got quite a lot of subsequent attention, was this question that actually it could apply to pretty imminent arrangements. And there was concern also from some Conservative MPs that I spoke to about that, that if they get the management of that wrong, it might not work in their favour. And fundamentally, it also might distract from what they think is otherwise a positive, in their view, a tough package of reforms.
Very good. Very good. Finally, a Tory MP.
Tory MP James Morris. I include this because it was one of quite a few semi-critical questions from the backbenchers today on issues that I think you would expect the Liberal Democrats, possibly, but certainly Labour, to raise: issues around healthcare, issues around rivers and dental care. But this is about the Mental Health Act. And you remember that Keir Starmer used that Prime Minister's questions just before the budget to go on mental health. This is something that those around Keir Starmer want the Labour leader to be talking about a bit more, and I think we should expect to hear more from them on this area. They say, especially among young people, it's a much more salient issue with the electorate than people often think, and James Morris making it quite clear that he thinks a number of Conservative MPs might well agree with that assessment.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister is rightly focused on taking long-term decisions to improve the lives of people in this country. So can I make a suggestion? Our mental health legislation is 40 years old, and we made a manifesto commitment in 2017 and 2019 to reform the Mental Health Act, because we have people with learning disabilities and autism sectioned under the Act, being kept an inappropriate accommodation for long periods. We have people sectioned under that Act not receiving the compassionate care that they deserve and, in a sense, are criminalised. And we have people sectioned under that Act who have their mental health condition re-stigmatised by the act of sectioning. So would the Prime Minister, in the absence of a bill in the King's Speech, would the Prime Minister agree to meet with me and other like-minded colleagues to discuss how we might be able to take forward reform of the Mental Health Act, because it simply isn't fit for the 21st century?
Well, can I thank my honourable friend for raising this important issue? He's absolutely right about the work that needs to be done, and I'm grateful to the Joint Committee on the Draft Mental Health Bill, and our intention is, when parliamentary time allows, to bring forward a bill. I'd be happy to meet with him and colleagues to discuss this, but also just remind everyone that we are undertaking the largest expansion of mental health services in a generation, £2.3 billion of extra funding by March of next year, increasing capital investment in mental health urgent care centres, and under the long-term workforce plan, the largest expansion of the mental health workforce that we've ever seen in this country.
Speller.
And this has been a long-running thing across parties, isn't it, Lara, about what's happening to the Mental Health Act?
Yeah, but also it was a manifesto commitment. And I think, some of the more loyal Tory MPs will bristle a little bit at hearing that fact repeated there in the Commons by James Moores. But even so, I think it's an interesting and important question. This was something Theresa May was known to be quite passionate about, although it's not that we've heard anything disobliging from her on this question. But I think an interesting omission in the King's Speech, and certainly one to come up.
And when you look at the story we had on the front of the paper at the weekend, which is about the sort of the widening gulf between haves and have-nots exacerbated by lockdown, one of the areas that was the starkest was mental health.
Yeah.
And it's obviously a very serious subject that tends not to be a political football, but I think it's one where everybody...
And some critics of the government might suggest they could have spent this week rushing through the promised changes to the Mental Health Act instead, which might have had a real-life impact in the real world, but that's not for me to say.
I mean, it's also, just quickly, on the back-to-work budget and the plans that Jeremy Hunt and Mel Stride, his work and pension secretary, have on economic inactivity and getting that number down. This is a really big part of that. The long-term sickness numbers do include a number of people with mental health problems. That's rising, so this is a big part of even, the most basic of economic assessments.
Well, there we are. Lara Spirit, you're right, it was good. Lara Spirit, Redbox editor, will be in your inbox at...
3 p.m.
With your last PMQs Unpacked email of 2023. Tim, happy Christmas.
Thank you very much, man.
Thank you for all of your devolution of jokes.
It's been an interesting year, hasn't it?
Can we top Zippy next year? That's the question.
Yeah, that's the question.
And that's all we've got time for on the last PMQs Unpacked of the year. Don't forget to make sure you're subscribing to both Redbox and How to Win an Election. It's Peter Manderson, Daniel Finkstein and Polly McKenzie guiding you through what is going on in politics and how it might play.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.